Welcome to the Morning Magazine for January 16th of 2023. Thank you for tuning in to your listener-supported community radio on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day. We have a special program for you featuring two esteemed guests. Dr. Rayland Rabaka is the director of CU Boulder's Center for African and African American Studies, also known as The Cause for short. He's authored multiple books and dozens of articles and has a packed schedule today. Also joining us is Candace Bailey, community organizer and changemaker. In 2021, she successfully challenged a law that would have barred her from running for the City Council of Aurora, where she lives. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Shannon. Thank you for having us.
Good morning. And again, thank you for having us as well.
So let's start off with what's in store for today. Dr. Rabaka, you have a few things going on here in the city and county of Boulder this morning and into the afternoon. Why don't you tell listeners where they can find you today?
I'm keynoting the City of Longmont's Martin Luther King Jr. Day 2023. If I'm correct, Silver Lake High School, 10 a.m. through 12 noon. And there will be a gospel choir there. There will be my incredible colleague, Professor Niarma Sarwa, will be doing dance. There will be Martin Luther King Jr. arts-based projects for the youth. This is family-friendly programming. We want to make sure that we can include everybody.
And I believe anybody who may want the details can find it on the website of the NAACP of Boulder County.
Yes, absolutely. And they are the key sponsors along with the city, you know, the City of Boulder, City of Longmont, but also this is Boulder County. What we're trying to do is make sure that we are celebrating King here in Boulder County, because again, a lot of us have, for me, for the last 20 years almost, I've been going to Denver. So it's important for us to be able to do both. And to have this collabo, which means collaboration, between Boulder County and the Denver metropolitan area.
Well, how about you, Candace Bailey? You live in Aurora. What do you have planned?
So my early morning, I'll likely go into Denver. I like to skip places, so I'll come into Aurora's event. I'll hit some Denver, but then I'll be here heading to the Dairy Arts Center in the afternoon to see Colette Payne and the Reminders. I am thoroughly excited. I am overjoyed to see Dr. Rayland Rabaka, Colette Payne, and the Reminders really talk about the issues that Martin Luther King Jr. himself was experiencing, that we continue to experience in our society today, and that we are addressing head on in a way that has never been addressed before. And so I'm going to have a jam-packed day. I wish I could make it to Longmont to see Dr. Rabaka, but I don't think my hovercraft can go that fast currently. So it's going to be a beautiful day of reminders, celebration, experience, education, and really putting youth at the forefront. The Dairy Arts Center, we will have youth in the building. Bring your family that is part of this. I think there's a misinterpretation that our children are not old enough to experience some of these things, and they're experiencing them. So I think we shy away from a lot, but our children have a doctorate in a lot of things that we act as if they're not experiencing. So please bring your youth, bring your children. They overstand what is happening in real time. Give them that respect and give them a full circumference of everything that has occurred in our country and how we can do better.
Candace Bailey, you're a monologuist with Modus Theater. You have years of experience. Can you give us an overview of what you've done with Modus? And specifically, I wanted to ask about your more recent trip to the Fair and Just Prosecution Conference.
Absolutely. Gosh, so Modus is not just a segment. It is a life experience. It is a full circle healing experience. For someone with lived experience, it is very rare and uncommon that you actually go to root causes which led to your incarceration. Root causes that continue to influence your daily life, whether you're reactionary or whether you're visionary. And I, with Modus, it is not just the things that I have done on a stage. It is a full embodied, whole human being experience. It is a sisterhood inside of our group. And so we have done so much already in such a short period of time. So for 28 weeks, we met every Saturday for hours. We cried our eyes out. We wrote journals. We became intimately involved with ourselves from birth to current day. And we delve back into the experiences systemically that we had not even thought of, how it paved a pathway to lead to our incarceration. And then we bloomed. And it was such a different experience because we were on stage the first time at the Dairy Arts Center as an entire group. And we all read our monologues. And that was a cathartic experience, to say the least. We then kind of broke off. It was people choosing what monologues they felt were addressing the needs that they were attempting to meet, whether they were DAs, whether they were performing arts. It was a vast majority of DAs that were interested in changing prosecutorial practice around the United States. And so in December, we went to Austin for the Fair and Just Prosecution Summit. It was phenomenal. So initially when I found out about this, for some reason, I heard the number 16. Kirsten says there will be 16 DAs there, and probably, I don't know, 5 days prior, it didn't translate. She said between up to 6D. And I said, wait a minute. Can you spell that? And she said, S-I-X-T-Y. And I said, whoa. And I had to sit with that for a moment, because there was a different impact even inside of me that existed, to have the overstanding of how many lives I could potentially be touching was so phenomenal. And it just so happened that that day there was a report that was released about sexual violence against women who are incarcerated. I cried tears that day. And the experience was so different, because it was the realization that I was not just speaking hollowly into the universe and no one was hearing it. It was knowing that my voice would speak for every woman that was now identified inside of a data pool that white supremacy had oppressed for hundreds of years. And I picked up a book that day by the American Bar Association called The 10 Principles on Reducing Mass Incarceration. A really thin book, very thin. I grabbed one for everyone. And I've been reading that book. And the statistics inside that book are sickening. In 2001, 118 Black women in 100,000 would end up incarcerated. 17 white women to that same 100,000 would end up incarcerated. The gravity of having data that exposes that Black women are incarcerated at 5,000% that of their white counterparts. Did I know all of these things? Absolutely, because I lived these things. I experienced these things. I knew that we were being captured and quartered in a way literally that I couldn't describe to other people. And as it was as if blinders were on the entire world. And the things that we have done with MODIS, I believe, are what is required in order to stop silence, ambiguity, systemic oppression, the continued mass incarceration of Black and Brown women, Black men. The link between immigration, incarceration, slavery, chattel slavery, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Assata Shakur, asylum. There are so many interconnections that we will not make. We must make, and we are beginning to make those connections. When you have more than 60 DAs from around the nation who are looking at what mass incarceration is doing, what restorative justice practice looks like, what restorative justice systemically looks like. We must bring the human component, and storytelling is the number one way. Theater, art, and music will always have a pull that you cannot imagine. Our sisters came and sang, and the sound of grace is, they will take over a space with the tone. You may not even hear the word, but the emotion will take your soul to a place you have not experienced.
And you can't say I'm a dreamer.
To shout out Kirsten Wilson, her genius, her brilliance. She is the artistic director of Modus Theater. This woman, you don't even know you're with greatness. Let me just say this, okay? I'm like, who is this lady who thinks she's going to sit down and write my life? Write my life, like such an intimate experience with incarceration. And I truly believe that Kirsten's gift is to open the ears and eyes of those who simply have been blind and deaf to the reality of what the rest of us are experiencing. She continues to bring people into the room like Dr. Raylan Rabaka. Are you kidding me? He is heading a center in Boulder. Let me tell you, I am from Colorado. I am a native. I used to go to parties in Boulder in my teen and 20 years. I went to CU Denver. And so I would go to CU Boulder for these parties. And I would be the sole Black person 9 times out of 10. And I'd be bringing Black people with me. And there was not discussions about African-American history. There was not discussions happening there to the degree, to the there. It wasn't even happening. It was not happening. And to see Dr. Rabaka in that space and know that his genius is in that room is absolutely phenomenal. I wish he would have gotten the recognition that Deion Sanders, Coach Primetime, got, because they are of the same altitude. They have taken things that were impossible. I am from here. Don't play. I know. Eric Bieniemy was the GOAT. Because he was the Black man who was running that ball in CU. Trust me, I know Eric. And when I think about how academia is discredited in a way that sports is not, it is absolutely disintegrating to my soul that Dr. Rabaka has not gotten the same platform as Coach Primetime, because he is doing academically what Coach Primetime is doing within the world of sports, in bringing our culture, our people, to a layer that we have not seen in Boulder County ever before.
Thank you, Candace Bailey. Well, let's take this to Dr. Raylan Rabaka. Why don't you tell folks who may be listening who aren't familiar with the center, the cause at CU Boulder, what you're doing there and how it started?
Wow. You know, I often say that this started when I came here, July 27th, 2005. I was a bit shocked, actually, when I came during the job interview, that a major research one, public university, did not have a African-American studies center, a Black cultural center, Black student services. It was kind of shocking compared to what's going on at Berkeley, University of Texas, Ohio State University, Michigan University. You know, I could just go University of Michigan, Michigan State. I could go on and on and on. And in fact, they started centers like this in the 60s, in the late 60s. So Colorado is about 50 years late, right? If you ride around Boulder, you can clearly see, you know, I don't know if some people got the memo about integration even, but I better stop. It's really interesting. Ooh, Lord have mercy. It's really interesting to sort of think about the founding of the center. And even the way that I went about founding the center was unique, because it was founded with students, right? So the president of the Black Student Alliance, students from the African Student Association, the Caribbean Student Alliance as well, like all of them coming together with a faculty member, right, to create this brand new center, the Center for African and African-American Studies. A lot of it grew out of my class on the Black Lives Matter movement. So that's where the initial petition started. In a course, I've been teaching a class on BLM for about the last 5 years. And what I want to do is provide my students with an education that's about the real world and in real time. And this is what they challenged me to do. So they would see me out in Aurora. They would see me out in Montbello. They would see me out in Denver at the rallies, certainly for Elijah McClain. And they said, you know, hey, Professor Rebaka, were you out here in these streets? You know, you tearing them up. Why don't you bring that to Bolden? I said, well, I'm trying not to, you know, be the next person with the BLM situation. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, it's just a really, really tricky situation. But I'm somebody who actually listens to my students. I learn from them. They are my teachers. I'd like to think they keep me a little hip to what's happening and everything. So this center actually grew out of students and faculty and, you know, coming together. And we started a petition. As you know, at the time, there was only about 800 Black students, but we got about 1,200 signatures. So we have a lot of allies in Boulder, and that's something I want to shout out. You know, this is in the spirit of Martin Luther King Jr., this whole notion of it's only together that we can really rescue and reclaim our humanity. So again, Shannon, what I'm saying right now is that I'm a little less human if all of your rights are not recognized. I say this to Candace. Candace already knows this about me. I believe that my humanity is deeply connected to your ability to express yourself at the highest level, to develop to your fullest potential. So that's why there's a wing of my work that is incredibly focused on girls and women, queer and trans folk, formerly incarcerated and currently incarcerated folks, folks that are immigrants. Right. And so there's a range center seeks to engage. And it's also it's a resource, Shannon. So more than a reference. Oh, the University of Colorado Boulder has this brand new center. No, we are a resource. By that, I mean, literally, folks can walk through the door 24/7. Well, not really. But anyway, most days of the week and learn some new things about Africa, the African diaspora and African-Americans, because I think that there's a tendency to always think of African people being anywhere but in the United States of America. And so here's an opportunity to actually learn about, I'm going to say it slow, our godmother, Harriet Tubman, our godfather, Frederick Douglass, and the fact that we are descendants of people who they have been in struggle since 1619. And in fact, anybody who really likes Martin Luther King Jr., Martin Luther King Jr. continued a struggle that started during our enslavement, right? And the progressive people we got together with in the abolitionist movement, yes? And so the civil rights movement is nothing but the 20th century version of the abolitionist movement. And now what I'm trying to do is expand the realm of possibility of what it is that we're talking about when we say abolition. We're talking about the abolition of not simply race and racism, but the prison industrial complex, the military industrial complex. I could go on and on. Let's talk about patriarchy. I want to live, ooh, Shannon, I feel good. Shannon, I want to live in a post-patriarchal world. I want to live, Lord God, I want to live in a post-heterosexist world, in a world after. I'm actually trying to reimagine, I feel like John Lennon, I'm trying to reimagine a whole nother world. I believe that another world and another way is possible.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Woo, 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 woo. And I'm feeling good.
I want to take this back to Candace Bailey, who is with the Just Us Monologues project of Modus Theater, who has personal lived experience with incarceration. Looking back on it now, with the time that has passed between the period of rapid ramp up and build up of the infrastructure to incarcerate, do you feel that the U.S. society is ready to instill abolition as quickly as it built up that prison industrial complex?
Well, I think you hit a couple of interesting points, and I want to actually give you a different thought process around that. So this is very deep and entangled. So in the U.S. Constitution, the word slave transforms to felon over 160 times. So I think that there is this misconception that this prison industrial complex just boom and happened. That is not the case at all. This is the evolution of slavery. So when you take a system that is created to oppress others, that is created to sell and trade other human beings, right? I think about this in the most easiest way. If you can't explain this to a kindergartner, you shouldn't talk about it. So here's the kindergarten explanation. The United States is a corporation. A corporation looks at return on investment. That is how they dictate whether they are prosperous, whether they are moving forward in the way that they want to. This United States of America, when established, made an investment in the human trade system. They created that as the cornerstone within this nation. Okay. And so why would we ever believe there is a truth in the idea that the number one commodity that built the United States would suddenly just disappear? No. There was an evolution. Businesses evolve within social culture, within social requirements. They change in order to meet what society wants, needs, and desires. That is the most successful corporations on the planet ever. It doesn't matter how you look at it. Now, you said something about how quickly they built the prison industrial complex. No. That is the evolution of the plantation. The plantation became the penitentiary. I don't need you to go and work on my plantation. I will simply lock you up in a penitentiary, and I will make more money off your back than I would with you out here beating your body up, picking cotton, whipping you, killing you. It didn't make sense. They were losing on their return on investment. And when people had an uprising and said, well, we don't want to do this anymore, they had to make a change in their business in order to appease those who were more conservative in the ideology of owning human beings. Now, take a bigger step and look a little bit wider. Big Pharma comes into play. So who became Massa? Big Pharma. Big Pharma becomes Massa because if you are in a penitentiary, in a carceral system, there is one strict requirement. You go to Medline, health evaluation, physical health evaluation, education evaluation. They evaluate the whole human being to figure out what to extract in order to continue their return on investment. So as you think that one of these things was built, it was not. It was synonymous. They came together hand in hand, and they have built themselves on return on investment. The largest is going to be Big Pharma and the prison industrial complex. There was an evolutionary process. So I don't believe that it was built. So the second half of your question about whether America, as quickly as you saw the perception of building the prison industrial complex, could we readily in the United States make the turn to abolition? And that's a very interesting thought process for me. I am an abolitionist. I've transformed throughout my life. And I think that is a progression that happens with an individual as you begin to do what I call pulling the sheets back. And I'm not talking about bed sheets. So as you begin to really dig into our history and how history is repeating itself in our society. I had a very interesting conversation with a friend of mine, and I said, I feel like we are in the confessional stage. So we went from a place where white people were very offended about being called out for having racist ancestors, symbolic statues, names of streets and schools and football teams, you name it, right? So we went from this place to a place now where people are readily coming out and doing confessional. Yes, I've been racist. Yes, I've said and done these things that were directly racist to another human being. And now I'm looking at it from the perspective of confessional to action, confessional to change. How do we actually get to the segue of change? And in my personal opinion, I believe that's the work that MODIS is doing, that Dr. Rebecca is doing, that I am doing by bringing a voice that allows the deaf and blind to hear and finally see the way that these things are happening. Now, abolition is a long walk. It is, you don't generally just wake up and boom, you're an abolitionist. I believe there is a process that happens within the human life. So abolitionists like Harriet Tubman were born into a situation and circumstance that required their abolitionists to show up much sooner than the rest of the planet due to circumstance, due to life experience. If you live it, you are more likely to want to abolish it. But if you never understand your connection, you will think that everything is just wonderful. That's okay. They got affirmative action. These are the types of things that you hear when you begin to listen and dig into the conversations that are the true meat and potatoes to not just forming an entire nation of abolitionists, but informing human first behaviors on the planet. This is not isolated to the United States. Unfortunately, we carry it forward and we're the ribbon girl, but our planet is experiencing all of these things, all of them. And so I believe personally, mothers will create abolitionists. Mothers are the nurturers on the planet. They teach the underlying moral compass on the globe. That is their job. And mothers will create abolitionists within their homes. That is what is happening. And that is the awakening. Women are awakening. Whether you're born it or you just identify, there is something about tapping into that innate feminine that allows a freedom and a liberation that we have never seen before because it prioritizes humanity. I believe it lives in us, Shannon. It is now the awakening. We are in the awakening. Once again, life is secular. That is humans. We are secular. There are only a few ways that we leave the planet and the cycles continue to happen. And so do I believe it is possible? It is more than possible. It is within our grasp. That means we must continue to do the work that we are doing and to continue to open eyes and ears in a way we have never thought of doing before.
I want to bring Dr. Raelynn Rebecca back into this conversation. As a teacher, as a professor, you are now in academia at a time when, while there is this awakening, there's also this backlash that's coming for what sometimes is conflated with critical race theory, but just any kind of examination of sometimes just flat out history. I want to ask you how this has been playing out for you in academia and with your peers. How has that been in these same years while there's an awakening? What's the backlash to it?
Wow. The reality of the matter is that there's always been academic boogeymen and buzzwords. So again, I don't want to do anything that puts me in harm's way. Because again, it seems like some people have freedom of speech, some people have academic freedom in this country, but not someone like me, you know, an African-American. So we have to be really careful with how we go about doing this. But in the spirit of Martin Luther King, I will say a lot of these people that are talking about critical race theory never define it. So the people that are actually beating up on it, if you ask them what it is, They never defined it. Same thing happens with people start talking about Martin Luther King Jr. They've only ever heard a few snippets of I Have a Dream. They've never read one single word that the man wrote. They have heard no other sermon or speech beyond I Have a Dream. And yet they think they know Martin Luther King, which is why, Shannon, this day, every year is so important. I actually think of MLK Day as Civil Rights Movement Day. So it's not, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. has this famous statement where he says, one man don't make a movement. That's the way I feel about my center. That's the way I feel about the legacy I'm trying to leave out here at the University of Colorado Boulder, in Boulder County, in the Denver metropolitan area, in the state of Colorado. Somebody like me from the projects isn't even supposed to be talking to nice folks like y'all. I'm not even supposed to be on here, right? I'm supposed to be mopping the floor of McDonald's or Walmart every night. I'm not even supposed to be on here. So to knuckle and brawl, oh God, to knuckle and brawl from the projects to the professorate, I got a whole new lease on life just sitting up here with y'all nice people. And since, Shannon, you gave me a platform, now you know y'all done really messed up and I don't want you to lose your job, baby. But since I have the platform, this is what we teach within the movement. We are not anti-white. I need to state that explicitly, that I'm about love. And because I love so hard, because I love so much, maybe the kind of love I'm coming with is just so unusual in this world. How could someone who acknowledges the enslavement, African-American enslavement, have the capacity to come to Boulder, Colorado and try to give a gift to a university like the University of Colorado Boulder, where, as you know, I mean, it ain't that many black folk out there. It ain't that many black folk out there. So the fact that this is my love letter to the white anti-racist allies, you know, this is my, first and foremost, obviously, this is my love letter to African Americans, because we need to just keep it real. I mean, that's primary, right? But also just for all those people that see the name of my center, the Center for African and African American Studies. I mean, there's a reason I didn't call it the Center for Black Studies. There's a reason I didn't call it this or that or the other. I think it's important to remind people of our Africanity. That's a big academic word. I'm gonna slow down, Shannon. That just means Africanity. Africanity means our African identities, our personalities. See, we have the shared humanity, but what if I'm acknowledging they attempted to dehumanize Harriet Tubman? I said attempted. They did not succeed, or else I wouldn't be on here dropping these bars on you so eloquently. They attempted to dehumanize Frederick. They did not succeed. See, they did not succeed. No one who's ever heard Martin Luther King Jr., no one who's ever heard Ella Baker could say that. Nobody who's ever heard Bessie Smith or Billie Holiday. Y'all better stop me. I'm feeling so good right now. You see? So for me, Shannon, the other part is when we started this program and we started talking about family-friendly programming for MLK Day, let me just state this as somebody that has been teaching a seminar on the civil rights movement for over a quarter of a century. One of the things I remind my 18 to 23-year-old students is that if you look at the documentaries, you'll notice it's mostly young people. A lot of young people are marching, protesting, demonstrating, practicing civil disobedience and passive resistance. Notice how many little children. And let me say this, Shannon, I'm gonna give you a quick lesson. This is for free, everybody. Emmett Till. Think about it. Here's a teenage boy, much like the Trayvon Martin of his generation in 1955. That sparked so many people, not just black folk, but many progressive white folk too, said, you know what, this is wrong. Think about it. Look at the Children's March. That's a real thing. They need to go look it up. See, they say in Martin Luther King, but they don't really know what he represented. That's why what MOTUS is doing is so important today. That is why an arts-based performance, because some of them, if I sing about Martin Luther King, If I write a poem like Maya Angelou, if I write a poem about my people, they can hear that. But if I just come out and say, you know, he was really criticizing the military industrial complex, they'll say, oh, we better go get him now. Y'all better get him down from there. He gonna get all of us in trouble. You see, that's what I'm talking about. There's something about us. In fact, in my work, I have a book called Civil Rights Music. In my book, Civil Rights Music, I developed the thesis. It's very simple. I say that Black folk can sing what we cannot say. See, they'll hear it if I put it in a song. Billie Holiday, 1939, Strange Fruit. That's a protest song. It's one of her most famous, right? If I sing it, they'll listen to me. But if I just come out and I come and rock these bars like you see me doing in the lecture halls at University of Colorado, you know, I rock the Rocky Mountains when I get in there, right? And my students, they're open to it. But what about providing them with models? Here are people that are 18 to 23, 18 to 25. Look at what they did with their youth. They're not just running around here talking about they sexy and they tight body, right? They actually doing something with their youth. That's all I'm trying to do. I've spent my life trying to do this. You know, I was a geek, Shannon. In fact, I still am a geek. I'm a nerd. You know, I read 3 to 4 books a week. I try to keep up with the little LeBron and the football every now and then. But there's nothing more important than me having my reading time every day. I'm watching that more. Love Coach Prime too. Shout out. Right. But at the reality of the matter is the academics. Studying, freeing your mind, getting with something, you just said, wow, people seem to have an aversion to multicultural as opposed to monocultural history. Typically, the history that they teach us K through 12 is obviously the history of the people that were victorious, right? The folks who were able to racially colonize Native Americans, to enslave African Americans. Right now we have so-called immigration issues, but only in the South, Shannon, not in the North. You know, do we have a Canadian immigration problem? I wonder why. Let's just ask some questions. Martin Luther King Jr. would ask some hard questions. Why is it that we only have a problem in the southern border where the brown people are? But I've never heard in my lifetime, I've never heard of a northern border problem. And you know, I don't think some of these people slipping in and out and whatever. And then I thought this country was for the free and the brave and all that. Like, isn't it open to everybody? Is there some contradictions going on? And didn't Martin Luther King Jr. spend his life not simply pointing out America's contradictions, but contributing to American democracy? Let's have a conversation about that, that there's a tendency for people to do everything on Martin Luther King Jr. Day other than actually study Martin Luther King Jr. That's part of my he's my primary point of departure on today. And he should be all of our primary, but what they've done is commercialized. They've sanitized Martin Luther King Jr. and everything is reduced to I have a dream. Nobody talks about, I'm gonna say it slow. Nobody talks about after the March on Washington, Shannon. The last 5 years of his life, he became much more politically radical. He started speaking about more than domestic issues, which got him in a lot of trouble, especially with the government. Now, again, they got a holiday in his honor. But again, we need to actually know about the real life of Martin Luther King Jr. What happened after? So the March on Washington was August 28th, 1963. What happened on August 29th, 1963? Till April 4th, 1968, the day that someone shot him in his face and assassinated him. See, there's a heaviness. See, there's this kind of, melancholia that happens to me every year about the middle of January, because people actually don't say, wow, this brother, one of the greatest pacifists that this country has ever produced, they shot him in his face. They slaughtered him. They shot, it was a kill shot. It was a headshot. It's over. And the sad thing is, Shannon, you see, it would seem that our country would have learned some things about this. Look at what JFK, headshot, assassination. Like this, something is going on in this society where there's this kind of ubiquity of violence. it's everywhere, right? What is happening is that many people are desensitized to it. They've normalized violence, but we really need to sort of talk about, I just think that there's so much more that we could learn from King. We're never going to achieve the dream if we don't talk about, right, the broader parameters of his work, his life, his struggle, his thoughts.
Modus Theater recently celebrated 10 years, their 10-year anniversary, and I was in the audience at that performance. And Candace Bailey, something that you said at that performance stuck out at me. And it was the connecting of the dots between what so many of the Undocu-America monologists had been saying and the experience of the Just Us monologist. Can you share that with our audience?
Absolutely. When I was sitting at the 10-year anniversary, I was watching, just like everyone else in the audience, Kirsten's brilliance on a screen. And I had not made certain connections that I did during that actual moment. I watched their experience literally play out on this documentary series. And it was very, it was like this strange emotional roller coaster, to be honest, because so many things that they had experienced, I had experienced. I was put in a cage. I was dehumanized. I was raped. My family was separated. Their experience is my experience. They were criminalized for the color of their skin. And I think Dr. Rebecca just hit the nail on the head. There isn't a northern border issue. It's a southern border issue with Black and brown folks coming across that border. And we don't even address the northern border issue of human trafficking. We don't. Our Indigenous women are taken across that border on a daily basis. Our children, Black and brown children, they don't take them south. Who's taking them south? No, people are coming from the south. They're taking them on that northern border. So if we think that the transatlantic slave trade route has changed, we are telling ourselves another convenient lie inside of that. And so sitting in that space and listening to every aspect of the lives that they had led that I had no experience in, but was in my familial history. I had a familial history of immigrants to this nation, and to hear their experience and to know that there was more in common than there was in difference said so much to me about the connectors between so-called immigration, refugee status, incarcerated people, the prison industrial complex, human trafficking, how we painted this pretty picture, but call a duck a duck, call a spade, say what it is. There is money being made off the backs of human beings who look like me, and they are sharing the same experiences that I am with a different name. They're just naming it something else. It is the evolution. Nothing has changed. It is modernized. It is literally transformed to meet the needs and the requirements. So you have a barge. You put human beings in that barge because you're supposedly moving items and goods from one nation to the next. Human beings end up in those containers, in those shipping containers, whether anyone recognizes this or not. They're delivered here to the United States. They come as refugees, as immigrants. They cannot work a regular job. They do not have access to things like healthcare and food. They have no rights. And then they're thrown in a cage. Sometimes they're an indentured servant. That's a term that was brought after that word slave. They prettied it up, and then they started calling the white people who were immigrants indentured servants. I know my grandmother was an indentured servant in this country from Slovenia, a white woman. We have not changed a thing. We have evolved all of these systems, all of these processes. Militarization, prison industrial complex, big pharma, human experimenting, food shortages. We're talking about eggs, for goodness sakes. Why? Why are we talking about eggs in the state of Colorado because they are $10 a dozen? You now can't get rainwater. Why? These are all the same things that happened historically to the indigenous. They are what has happened to the Africans that were brought here through slavery, and it continues and continues. There is nothing separate. We just have never made the connection because, you know what? We want to sleep good at night. We want to believe the lies that we tell ourselves. But I want everyone to look in the mirror and understand we have just upheld the same system from the transatlantic slave trade to today. It is happening. You follow that route, you are following the same route of immigration right now coming into the United States. You have people working literally on farms in Southern Colorado for less than a dollar a day, picking chilies. We have not changed. We have evolved and put new definitions and new keywords and terminologies and licensures and taxes. It has not changed. It has evolved. The evolution has happened before our eyes. And as human beings, we have made the decision to be complacent and not evolve away from those things. That idea of abolition only comes when we embrace the idea of liberation. And without them, we cannot live. We cannot make it any further. It will continue to be the same cycle of murder, death, kill. The oppressor changes faces, that's all.
Candace Bailey is a community organizer and abolitionist, a former candidate for public office in Aurora, monologist with Modus Theater. Thank you so much for your comments, your sharing your thoughts, your analysis. Dr. Raylan Rebaka is the director of CU Boulder's Center for African and African American Studies. To wrap up, I want to give both of you the floor for anything that you wanted to say that you didn't already state.
I think my final thought would be connected to what Dr. Rebaka said. We often look at phases in people's lives and we give them this extreme indifference historically for a singular moment. And we never look deeper at the impacts on their life past that moment. Especially when it comes to the civil rights era, when it comes to any movement that affects or touches on anti-Blackness in the United States. Recently, I did an interview with the New York Times, and it was coming full circle around the Elijah McClain experience. And I don't think that we as a society seriously look at the investment of those who are willing to be the voice, whether they want to or not, because I know many days, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, they shun the idea that their voice was the voice. As someone who is not a self-appointed leader, there is a requirement of responsibility that is much different than the outside world can understand. And the shallow narrative that has been painted by many of our historical Black figures does not tell the full story, because once we begin to tell those full stories, you will truly see the reign of white supremacy, oppression. You will truly have the blinders off and your ears wide open. But you see, we stop at the pretty part of the story. That's acceptable. And that's the problem. Much like Dr. Rebaka, I have had so many death threats, I cannot tell you. It is not something that we have chosen, but something we are subject to as a culture in the United States of America. And unless and until we are not willing to just put someone with my skin tone or my background on a stage and give them a platform for the moments that feel good, and never expose what their true experience was. What their true experience was, we will continue to live this cycle and pass it forward to generations. There is a quote, I believe it's Yoruban, and it says, even the king must bow to the future. That means I don't care what pedestal that you put yourself on. When the future comes into the room, you get down on your hands and knees and you tie that shoe. You make sure you lift their chin up. That is truly the legacy that Martin Luther King Jr. left to us and charged us with, indicted us with. The king must bow to the future. That is the only chance that we have. And I applaud Dr. Rebecca, Kirsten Wilson, for the work that they are doing to continue to allow the future to lead and to bring voice to humanity and tell the stories that we refuse to hear because we only want to hear the pretty parts.
All right, Dr. Rebecca, you have the...
Okay, here we go. Closing thoughts, just closing out. I would say, I would just remind everybody that one man does not make a movement. That's not something that Martin Luther King Jr. wants. If you really study his work, this is about aligning our words with our deeds. I'm not really interested in any ideas that are not about, that cannot be translated into action. And I think that's where I've spent a lifetime studying the civil rights movement. It is a model. And when we really do it, we can see the human complexity and creativity, yes, of African Americans, but also of the Native Americans who joined in the movement, the Latinx folks who joined in the movement, the Asian Americans who joined in the movement, and I'm going to say it really slow, the white folk or European Americans who joined in the movement. What if for between 1954, Brown versus the Board of Education, and about 1965, there was like, oh, think, let's really try to bring into being a multiracial, multicultural, multilingual, and multireligious America. The civil rights movement is this incredible model. And I think that Martin Luther King Jr. is only the tip of the iceberg. I'm always interested in the people who were right behind. What's the second row? So not the first row of the march. Look at the people right behind King. If we do that, Shannon, we also notice that about 75% of the people in those marches were women and girls. There's no way for us to talk about the civil rights movement if we're not willing to talk about how it was incredibly womanist. It was woman-centered, right? It was Black feminist inspired. And so I just want to close out shouting out my mama and my grandmama in them and talk about when I teach my civil rights movement seminar, I'm teaching Ella Baker. I'm teaching Rosa Parks, which again, there's this misunderstanding, Shannon, about Rosa Parks. People say, oh, well, she was tired. That's the reason she got arrested. Now, and she was old and tired is what they say. The only thing she was tired of was anti-Black racism and white supremacy. To say that she was old when Rosa Parks, we all know, just passed away in 2005. So how on the earth is she going to be old in 1955? Somebody, they need some arithmetic lessons, right? Right? They need some, oh, I better stop. Okay, so I teach Rosa Parks. I teach Ella Baker. I teach Septima Clark, and I teach the great Fannie Lou Hamer. There is no way to understand Martin and Malcolm and Medgar if we also don't understand Ella and Rosa, right? And Septima and Fanny. I think that there's a time for us to sort of balance things out and challenge ourselves to move beyond sort of the pop culture celebration of Martin Luther King Jr. Day and to like, let's go deeper. And I'm so honored and so proud to be a part of an arts-based celebration of Martin Luther King Jr. Day at Modus Theater. It has been a great honor of mine to be able to meet and learn from the incredible Candace Bailey. It has been an honor to meet and greet and learn from and work with down here in these trenches, which with Kirsten Wilson and Modus Theater. So I just want to shout out for if they like anything about what we have shared today, come on down in real time and check us out as we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. We use Martin Luther King Jr. as a point of departure to create for our creativity. And some of y'all already know, I draw from many different sources for my creativity, right? And right now, I would not have the Center for African and African-American Studies at the University of Colorado Boulder if I wasn't inspired by my students? Oh, they are my students are my works of art, Shannon. You know, I fashion myself an artist. I believe that teaching is an art, right? And my students, they are my works of art. I end as I began. I'll end with a quote from Ella Baker. In 1964, Ella Josephine Baker said, "Strong people don't need strong leaders because strong people lead themselves." I'm talking about collective leadership. I'm talking about participatory democracy. We don't have a democracy if everybody in this country is not a part of it. We have not yet achieved democracy. We are mouthing the words democracy, but we're not really yet living in a democratic society. That's what Martin Luther King Jr. gave his life for. Let's continue the legacy. Let's build on it. And dare I say, let's go beyond it.
I want to thank both of my very special and esteemed guests today for the rich, in-depth discussion that is so necessary, not just on this day, but every day. Candace Bailey, Dr. Rayland Rabaka, you can meet both of them today at 2 p.m. at Modus Theater. And also at the presentation at 2 p.m. will be the reminders. So let's close out with the music of the reminders.
Foundation, you see it.
You are listening to KGNU FM 88.5 Boulder, KGNU 1390 Denver.
To the Valley of Kings, where we willing and able to rise like burning fire, active volcano. Salute to rebels, poets, and people working for something greater. Self-determined, focused, and power when all together. Take our time with every step to remember the way. Never distract us, stay collected. With each breath, we speak life into existence. You know where to find us, majestic promised land. No, it's not a dream, we manifest visions and ceremony. Last of a dying breed, lead and inspire. By any means, we champions, obsessed, a healthy survivor, destined to grow with exceptional plans. Of being timeless, strong and everlasting, only reason with the virtuous.
Brick by brick and stone by stone. Brick by brick, I and I build the throne.
Prayers and the birds, we got no reason to worry. Divine time never hurries. We have futures to build for many generations to flourish. Our enemies, they suspicious with whispers and curses. They intentions is dirty, cause they vision is blurry. They can't see we raising nations with patience and perseverance. The presence of Holy Spirit, no wonder they evil fear us. We shout it from the mountaintops, so everybody here, loud and clear. Listen here, message made for every ear. We don't have to settle for these castles made of sand. We could build a kingdom for our people with a purpose and a plan.
Brick by brick and stone by stone.
Stone by stone.
Sound system, here's your plan.